So yes, we find ourselves celebrating one last solemn feast on a Sunday as we move out into the simplicity of ordinary time. This is how it typically goes this time of the year. We had the whole long Lent Easter run of the Paschal mystery of the dying and the rising of Christ that led us up to a couple Sundays ago, which was Pentecost, which capped off an entire spring meditation with the feast about the outpouring and unleashing of the Holy Spirit upon the face of the earth and upon the church, through the apostles and through all of us into the world, so Pentecost. Then the Sunday after Pentecost, per custom, the solemn feast of the Holy Trinity, that was last Sunday, to sort of put the exclamation point on the mystery of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit that we drank in all throughout the spring. It teaches about who God is and who we are. And then, at least in this country anyway, one more Sunday, this one, the feast of Corpus Christi, body and blood of Christ. Much of the world celebrates it on Thursday this past week, and we move it to a Sunday here. But either way, if last weekend was about the central dogma of our faith, of the Trinity, this weekend, let's call this a feast about the center of our worship in our faith, and the center of the church's liturgical life, the mystery of the Eucharist, the offering of the Mass, the gift of the Blessed Sacrament. So it's an old feast, been our long time, and we usually have processions on this day and all these kinds of ceremony and pomp to celebrate the idea and the truth and the fact that God lives among us in the tabernacles of our churches, he comes on the altars of our churches, and he feeds us with himself in the most blessed sacrament. Not just bread and wine, but in fact himself, body, blood, soul, and divinity. For Catholics, we know the Eucharist is a special, special gift indeed. It is the Lord himself who lives among us and feeds us with himself. So that's at the center of today's lovely solemn feast day. Now, as I always say, it's a huge topic, Eucharist, say a million things about it. What's the angle that we could take this year? Maybe we have a jumping off point that is dictated by a couple of different things. For one, this rotates, these Gospels do on our lectionary cycle. This is Luke's year, so we're going to get kind of a Lucan take on this. So the readings give us perhaps an angle on it, as does the current moment, because the fact is, while these feasts come around every single year, so they're always the same, we are different because life changes all the time. So in the year 2022, we come to this feast day from a different place than we probably did a year ago, just because the world is what it is. So knowing the readings and knowing the world, what's the angle on today's feast day on the Eucharist? How about this? Economics. Let's call it the economics and the cost-benefit analysis of the Blessed Sacrament. How about that for a pitch, right? Why? Well, to the state of the world. I don't have to explain to you here why economics is probably on our minds these days in a way that it wasn't a year ago, probably, or even like, say, 2 months ago. The stock market has been on a wild little ride, if we can put it that way. And obviously, we are all, I think, in our respective households learning more and more how to live with the fact that what was once less expensive in our country is now suddenly very expensive, and it changes life, and it produces the difficulty of scarcity into our own homes and into our routines. It's what makes choices, what makes trade-offs. I don't have as much of this anymore, I have to buy this or that thing, so economics, I think, is on our hearts and minds. What do things cost? Bread, gasoline, necessities. There are, of course, still supply chain shortages that afflict us in our Western world. So I think we bring all this, I suppose, to the feast day, and we might ask ourselves the question, I guess, well, Eucharist, that's great, Brother Nathan, is it going to cost me anything? What does it cost these days? How much of the value and the inflationary aspect of the Eucharist go up, perhaps from, I don't know, a month ago, right? Maybe that's how we're thinking. Who knows? But also, you might say that economics frames the readings a little bit too for today's feast day if one looks carefully around the edges of them. And the first reading, that one is less obvious, but it is there, in the book of Genesis. Interesting little story, what happens. I'll summarize because it's a long, long story. Abram's brother Lot is captured in a battle. He's taken out. Abram wants him back. They go to battle. He wins him back, gets Lot back. And to celebrate in thanksgiving for God's deliverance from this bad situation, Abram knows he must offer a sacrifice. He owes God something. There's a price, you might say, for this good blessing that he received. And so God, in this mysterious kind of way, sends this guy named Melchizedek, sort of out of nowhere, without parents or lineage. What does he do? He's a priest of peace, of Salem, and he offers bread and wine. And that becomes the thanksgiving sacrifice to God for this victory and for all of God's blessings. So it's an act of worship that's happening in the first reading. Like this morning, act of worship. What does that act of worship cost Abram? It says that Abram gives Melchizedek a tenth of everything. Now, those of us who tithe, right? Tithe in the Old Testament comes in one part from this passage. It's a tenth of all of one's possessions. Abram had a lot of stuff. Now, I'm not a math person, but 10% of a lot of stuff is a lot of stuff. How's that for modern education for you, right? There it is. The point is, he forked a lot over for the sacrifice, right? So if that's any kind of precedent, then this morning we could ask the question, well, what is mass going to cost today? I'm going to say 10%. Basket's coming around in a few minutes, okay? It's a transaction, so to speak, in the terms of the first reading. Why? Because Abraham knew that God was owed so much because the blessing was so, so profound. So he knew that he had to pay a price, so to speak, from the depths of his heart. But more to the point is the gospel. Here we find the Lord and the 12 and the crowds on the seashore of Galilee at the place that today is called Abga. You can go there today and visit it. And they have run up against this problem. Jesus has been teaching and he's been curing. And the apostles say to him, you know, these crowds have nothing to eat. You should send them home. We have a scarcity problem here, Lord. This is an economics issue. We're out of this, we're out of that. And if you keep talking like you are, they're going to faint from hunger. So dismiss them. So this sets up the fact that the apostles were thinking, as we often do, especially these days, in economic materialistic terms. Money, provisions, supplies, this is what's on their mind. And it makes sense. It's very practical. It's very concrete. The Lord's answer to them is interesting. He tries to move them beyond mere economics, to push them beyond the needs of the moment in the material sense. And he says to them, well, why don't you feed them? And the response is classic. They look around and say, look, we got to go buy food for all these people. As if to say, we're not paying for that. See, 5,000 men, so let's call it 25,000 people here. We don't have that kind of money. This is beyond our material means. This is a deserted place. So it sets up this great scene of human want and human lack. So call this scene, I guess, any era in history, any era in our lives, where we find ourselves saying, I'm out of something. Be it as simple as bread, gasoline. I guess that's an era of want these days, right? But maybe it's a spiritual desert. We're out of spiritual gas. We're frustrated, challenged, annoyed about work, about family, about kids, about job, about the world, about politics. We all find ourselves in some sort of deserted place once in a while. We say to God, I've hit the limits of my resources, and the remedy is a price that is too much for me to pay. In the earthly sense, as I look around and try to figure out what's at my fingertips, I can't solve this problem. It's too big. This is economics. It's also, if you will, spiritual economics. It's a situation of deep human want. So, first reading in its way, gospel in its way, tee up, if you will, the scenario of the Eucharist as something of an economic idea, cost-benefit analysis, right? So, knowing that as a bit of a background, which sets up the gospel story and the problem of want, what might be, from a Catholic perspective, a cost-benefit analysis of the Eucharist that this gospel opens up for us? From a benefit perspective, what do we get out of it? Well, we know, as Catholics, this is the bread of heaven. This is the bread of life. This is the sustenance for our discipleship journey, the walk of life. This is the food that we cannot live without. This is the presence of God on our altar. This is what we starve ourselves of if we don't get to Mass. So the food of angels, the bread of heaven, again, we sit ourselves, you can't sit off enough. It's not just a symbol on the altar. It's God dwelling among his people. And he wants to feed us with the gift of himself. So this is tremendously important food. That's the benefit. We might say to ourselves, well, how can I pay for that? Surely the cost must be too, too high. We know that we need this. We know that we want this. What's it going to cost me, especially in our inflation-driven world these days? The gospel gives us something of the answer. And the answer is a little bit tricky. It goes kind of like this. It costs us nothing. on one basic level. What does the Lord do, back to the gospel, in this little situation of human need and want and the limits of our resources? He says to them, what do you got? I got 5 loaves and 2 fish. Okay, so he takes that simple, small little amount of resources, and what does he do? He does a legitimate miracle. He multiplies them. To do this, he first looks up to heaven, that's what the text says, which is his way of leading them to understand that the solution to this problem is not going to be earthly, it's not going to be material, it's not going to be economics, which is what we're always stuck in. While it's important, it has its limits. This is going to be a heavenly thing. It's going to be divine. It's going to be a God intervening in human history. It's going to be a God doing something that's beyond our ability to pay for or finance or bankroll. He looks up to heaven, the place of providence, to his Father's place of provision, and from there comes the solution to the human want of our hearts and our spiritual deserts. And he takes the bread, and he takes the fish, and he prays over this, and he breaks the bread, and he gives them to the disciples to say, here, give these out, and just keep giving and giving and giving. And they don't run out. In fact, how does it end? They have 12 wicker baskets full left over. So this is a gesture on God's part of profound, profound abundance. This is lavish, lavish, lavish. God took human want, inserted heaven into it, and all of God's power, and what was the end result? More than they could handle, more than they could eat, more than they could need. So it's his way of telling them and us all throughout human history, this is a Eucharistic miracle, okay, that the food of the altar, while it is this precious, precious thing, is given to us for, if you will, free. It doesn't cost us anything. Not only that, God's going to give it to us in abundance. He wants to shower us. All those leftover baskets, right, think about that as all the grace that is packed into the Blessed Sacrament, into the Mass, into our worship, into our ritual. But he wants to shower us with this beautiful gift of himself. So in our world of rising crisis, so to speak, and scarcity, we say, there is the Eucharist, it's given in abundance, it doesn't cost us anything, it is free food. That's tremendous, right? That's good news these days, free food. And not only food, it's the best food. It's heavenly food. And when we say to ourselves and to God, surely I can't pay for that, he's like, you're right, you can't. There is no way you can pay for it, so I'm going to give it to you in abundance, in a lavish, lavish, overflowing manner. So the gospel is an economics story in the sense that, in the earthly sense of the term, God's economics is well beyond our mere material means to grasp and figure out. He provides. Think about this. Down through history, through all the ups and downs, ins and outs, right? No matter if we're in poverty, if the world is in a good place or a bad place, what's our constant? What do we have? How are we nourished? We always have the food from the altar. So it's like this basic staple of life and of the church. And of necessity, it's always here. It's not tied to the market, thank God. Okay? It's not tied to everything else. It's to be so messed up around us. It's just simply a constant. So it's a beautiful, beautiful gift from God. It's just all of us in a cost-benefit scenario. It's yours. It's a gift. I know you can't pay for it, therefore I'll bankroll it for you. That is really, really good news. There's a catch. It goes kind of like this. The cost for it isn't so much economics. It's not about a pocketbook, right? Because the fact is, there is the reality that one must invest something in the sacrifice. And it goes like this. One must invest faith. One must believe it. That's the trick. So I'm not going to put so much money into God's hands to get this great food, but he does expect you and me to understand who it is, what it is, what it means, even just a little bit. And he says to all of us, you know, like those loaves and fishes that they handed over, they had to give something for the experience. A community of faith is what's going to get the Eucharist given to it. An assembly of believers who gather, who take time on a Sunday, who adjust their day, who come to the Mass, and who invest in it with their mind and with their heart, and make the decision of faith to believe in its power and to accept it on its terms. To that community, God is going to give this priceless, precious food. Not to non-believers, not to secularists who think they have no time for this stuff. In a similar mode, okay, God is going to give this food, it'll come down on the altar, but if we're here at Mass, investing nothing in it, not paying attention, not coming to pray, but in this kind of passive, entertain me kind of sense, it's not going to have the power that it should have. So one must invest in it, our worship, and our prayer, and our hearts, and our lives, and ourselves. So the cost, if you will, is that we must have faith. Additionally, and this is related, right, we're not going to have it if there are not priests around. You need one of me around to have the Blessed Sacrament on the altar. Okay? Where do priests come from? They come from communities and hearts and minds that decide to accept the gospel on its terms, on God's terms, and not to try and have it some other way. So communities and families and hearts that understand the church in its fullness, the sacraments in their fullness, and accept them for the grandness that they are, produce more priests and more people in the pews, and from those places comes the bread from heaven. So what's the cost? I guess my life, in the sense that I lay it down for you so we can have this food, and everyone, mine and yours, faith. That's our 10%, that's our tithe this morning. It's the offering of belief. This is, God, I believe in this, I love this, I worship this, I don't want to live without this, and because I know with the eyes of faith that it's not bread, I give my life to it, and because of that, I can be fed by it. Without that, though, the pews empty out, the priests go away, the parishes fold up, and the faith dissipates. So what does God want from us? What's our price? We have to believe. We have to believe. Now, is that so bad? I mean, think about that from a cost-benefit perspective. I mean, isn't that a great thing to invest in? Belief, faith, something that is unseen and beyond me and deeper than me and broader and higher than me. Can I not invest in that? I think the answer is yes. Indeed, I must. No? So it's the kind of price we should all be willing to pay. It's hard, but it's return that has a millionfold gift to it, right? So, here we are on a beautiful feast day, right? From the perspective of economics, the reality is we're talking about food here that we can't buy in any earthly sense of the term. It's well beyond our ability to be able to pay for, finance, bankroll. God says, that's okay. I know that. From your place of want, your place of lack, all through history, I will always feed you with a food that is free for you in the economic sense of the term. You can't possibly pay for this. No way. So I'll do it for you. So generous, so lavish, so overwhelming am I in my abundant generosity. So we praise him for it. And today, I think, on the feast day, we commit ourselves to believing in it. He feeds us, and we say to him back, I resolve to be a believer in this great gift, to be devoted to this great gift, to worship this great gift, to receive this great gift, to be transformed and challenged and shaped by this great gift into it, into itself, and take it on its terms, not on my terms. Mass on its terms, not on my terms. To invest in the worship on its terms, not on my terms. So that's the price I'm going to pay for the tremendous gift I get back, which is the bread of life itself, and the food that takes me into heaven one day in the friendship of God the Most High. That's not a bad transaction, I don't think anyway. I give my heart, or I get back the food of angels. What can be better than that? We adore the Lord in his holy sacrament today. We worship him. We are in awe of it, and resolve to love it, to serve it, and to worship it, and to believe in it all the days of our lives.